Sure, it's always a blessing to come. Of course, I'll come back. And good news is, I don't have to fly on a plane, which means you don't have to take off your shoes or your belt or anything else. I do go for the pat down, but nevertheless, that was a joke. I don't really need to go for the pat down on that. Thank you so much for making the nice breakfast dish for us that your hubby brought this morning. He said that you made that, and he didn't take credit for it. So thank you very much. Thank you, Pastor, again for the invitation. I got to move this over. Okay, quiz time. That's what's nice about smaller audiences. Quiz time. I love quiz time. We covered three key questions yesterday. One of them was, how do you understand and interpret Genesis 1 and 2? That's actually two questions. So, I don't know if you're going to do this, but in terms of how I gave the answer for that, how did I understand Genesis 1 and 2? It was, someone said it, historical narrative. It's an historical narrative. It's not poetry. It's not allegory. Not fiction. It's an historical account. Therefore, if it's historical, we should be careful in using the word story when we're talking to the little kiddos. Let me tell you the Christmas story, the Easter story. No, these are really historical accounts. And I know in the big picture they're stories, but story kind of conveys the idea of what? Something that's kind of fanciful, magical, mystical, and things like that. And then how did I interpret Genesis 1 and 2? I didn't necessarily say I gave it a literal interpretation. I gave it a normal, which means we give words their normal meaning in their normal context, just like we do all other language. Okay, question number two was, what's your take? What's your take on Darwinian evolution? Darwinian evolution was a weak, weak scientific theory. Don't go out and say, it's crazy. Nobody will listen to you past saying that. Just say it's a weak scientific theory and a poor explanation for the design we see in nature. That's all of those are important. And tonight we're going to zero in on the design we see in nature. And then the second part of that question was, and its compatibility with Christian faith. That the basic tenets of evolutionary theory are what? Totally incompatible with Christian faith. Primarily in relationship to one thing. Who is Adam? Who is Adam? Was Adam real? Was Adam fictitious? That's the main thing. The Bible says there was a real Adam who brought real sin, real death, needing for all of us real salvation. That's a biggie. Theistic evolution can't point to a real Adam. In fact, they don't say there was a real Adam. So that's really, really important. And then finally, are you open to nature pointing to design or seeing design in nature? The answer was clearly yes. And we talked about adaptation, adaptability. Now, why are we talking about adaptation? Because there are four main biological functions. Organisms all grow. Organisms all reproduce. Organisms all metabolize. Metabolize means you take food and you convert it to energy. Or you take food in and you build yourself up into something. That's metabolism. But organisms all adapt. And that is the key thing, because organisms can change. They can adapt. Some of you are changing even now, and you're adapting to things. And if I shot a gun off, pow, in here, didn't tell you I was going to do it, your heart would jump. That would be an adaptation. Instantaneously, it's fight or flight. It's getting you ready to do that. So everybody's adapting. And since organisms can change, then you can get a theory of evolution going, because if they can change a little bit with a lot of time, they can change what? A lot of it. A lot. And that's how evolutionists think. But what did Darwin really change? So we're going to talk about doing biology as if Darwin had not been born. And that isn't even my phrase. So I'm going to give credit to the man who I heard it from. His name is Paul Nelson. And I thought it was a great phrase. I've probably said it to more people than he's ever going to. but it's his phrase. We need to do biology as if Darwin had not been born, and which means basically we're going to go back to the way biology was done before Darwin introduced his theory. And his theory is going to deal with adaptation. And adaptation is vital. So whoever is controlling the explanation for how organisms adapt is controlling the crossroads. So for some of you World War II buffs, that's why I have the picture up there of Bastogne. Everything was going through Bastogne on that Battle of the Bulge. And you needed to control that city, which the Americans did. So that's why it's really, really important today. And I'm going to introduce, and I started to talk about this, a type of engineered adaptability that organisms were designed to adapt, but really it's broader than just design. They were engineered. They were engineered to adapt on purpose. And this morning for the men's breakfast, I introduced this theory. It's actually a model to explain how organisms adapt. And we've titled the model Continuous Environmental Tracking. Continuous environmental tracking, which means right now as I'm speaking, you don't know it, but your body is monitoring its environment. It's monitoring the internal environment. It's monitoring the external environment. And even right now, you're doing small physiological adaptations, but it's continuous. You never stop doing it. And you don't stop doing it from physiological adaptations to adaptations that are going to happen in your lifetime, to some which may happen in your lifetime, in your children's lifetime, to some which are going to happen over many generations. It's continuous. And you're tracking it. You're tracking the environment. And you're tracking it with the same mechanisms that man-made tracking devices do it. So, the major assumption of this model, which is based on a theory of adaptation, is that biological functions are going to be best explained by engineering principles. Tomorrow, in the service, I'll unpackage from a biblical standpoint. Why is this a good assumption? And why is this a solid assumption? And why does it point us in the right direction that biological functions are going to be best explained by engineering principles? But I'm going to illustrate it tonight in many ways, and then about a third of the way through the talk, we're going to take a parenthetical break, and I'm going to explain some of the theory that Darwin introduced and the philosophy, which is going to intersect with theology. But as you see up there on the screen, I'm expecting corresponding elements. I'm expecting that organisms are going to have systems with components of those systems arranged in a specific way, which are going to correspond to how human engineers would build things, and that is going to point towards design. Now, you see there up on the left-hand side of the screen, you see that car that has a big GM on it. It wasn't built by Ford. I have to, when I go to Texas, I got to kind of tell them that. Sorry, but I know we have our resident Texan here, but she's a good sport. She's a good sport, and she's not wearing her Texas shirt that she had on last night. That was a classic, something in the shape of Texas on that. Okay, whether you're from Texas or not, this was built by GM. But you notice that there's all kinds of stuff sticking out on this car. That's because this car does not have a driver. And this car, if you could put an unlimited amount of fuel in it, it could drive from San Francisco to New York City. It could drive around traffic jams. It could drive around tornadoes, particularly if it was going through Texas. But anyway, it could drive around all kinds of bad weather on those kinds of things because it can get data from satellites. It can get data from weather. It can sense things all around it. It is a really, really sophisticated car. Do you think they have some pretty good computers in it? Yeah, computers and responses. But organisms are doing the same thing. You'll see there up on the right-hand side of the screen, there's a headline from the paper, New Scientist. Read the headline. Guinea pigs, how big is that? Okay, you guys got good peepers? You can read that? Even in the back of the room? Miss Texan? Okay, good. All right, good. Guinea pigs do what? Beat climate change by doing what? tweaking their own DNA. Tweaking their own DNA. How in the world does that happen? Think about that while I grab my water. Change. Oh, I'm so mad that we're burning coal. Anyway, that doesn't fly in Gillette very well. By the way, all that carbon dioxide that's locked up in the coal, I mentioned this to Pastor yesterday, that coal used to be plants, right? Where do plants get their carbon dioxide? From the atmosphere. So when you burn coal, you're putting back into the atmosphere carbon dioxide, which was where? In the atmosphere. It started there, and you put it back there. What happened? Along came a monster flood. Only one time in Earth history, which ripped up vegetation, packed it together, and deposited so that you could get coal seams 80 to 100 feet thick. Now, where do you see that happening on Earth today? Nowhere. So during the flood, it took all that vegetation, which had trapped all that carbon dioxide, and it trapped it. It trapped it in those layers. So it essentially took the carbon dioxide out and held it there. And now we're just releasing it back in to the atmosphere. Anyway, I diverge. So these guinea pigs are beating climate change by tweaking their own DNA. How in the world does this happen? Well, I gave you some remarkable illustrations yesterday. Here's another one. You got to hang with these stories. You take these male guinea pigs. Why do they always pick on the males? I don't know. But it was last night, it was the male mice that they shocked their feet. Now you take these male guinea pigs. Okay, and you're what? You're a diabolical biologist. And you want to see if they're going to beat climate change. So you put them in a cage. And at the bottom of the cage, you put a big heating pad. And you crank up the heat inside the cage to where you think it's going to be like what global warming is going to do. Well, if any of you understand male guinea pig anatomy, what's down there next to the heating pad? You're kind of roasting them, all right? And you roast them for 70 days. Why? Because that's how long it takes to make one cycle of sperm. It takes about 70 days to produce some viable sperm. So you cook them for 70 days. And then you take these male guinea pigs and you do what? You mate them with a... what kind of female? A naive female. Remember that last night? You got to find a naive female. And it's good luck finding a human one. But anyway, so you try to find a naive female, which means she hasn't been cooked. And then she has pups. And then you sequence the DNA of the pups. And lo and behold, we know which genes. We know which genes relate to thermoregulation, some of them. And in these genes, in these pups, they have 12 genes. The genes have not been modified, but the expression of the genes have been modified, all of them relating to their ability to withstand higher temperatures. One generation, just like that. Now, do you think those male guinea pigs have a temperature sensor? Of course they do. You're not going to detect temperature unless you've got some kind of sensor. And they have programming. And it's adjusting things in real time. It's adjusting the markers on those sperm in real time. Now, evolutionists, they obviously don't have a way to explain this. But better yet, we can explain it. We can frame it. We can frame it in terms of a tracking system. Humans devise systems which are able to track things all over the place. Why can't creatures have been designed to track their changes and respond appropriately? That's the model. So as you see it there on the screen, human tracking systems have sensors. I went through this yesterday. Then the data from the sensor goes to there's going to be a quiz on this at the end of this talk, so please get these down. It's going to go from sensor to logic mechanism, which is logic that says, if this, then do that. If this, then do that. And then it's going to have an output response. So you have what? Sensors, logic, output. Sensors, logic, output. Pretty straightforward. And all man-made tracking systems, they have more than those things, but they have to have at least those three things. And all creatures have to have those at least those three things. If you're missing any one, it's not going to work. So you have those things, and you have them in your cells going on. So what creatures seem to be doing is continuously tracking environmental changes and producing purposeful responses, not hit and miss, not helter-skelter, but very, very targeted, purposeful responses. And they're not doing it through a mechanism. They're doing it through many, many mechanisms, all with the same purpose of tracking changes, but many different ways to get there to tracking those changes, which enable these self-adjustments. And so the characteristics of how this is described are going to match the characteristics of human design things. And those characteristics, as I mentioned yesterday, there were several R's. They're highly what? Regulated. They're rapid. They're repeatable. Sometimes they're what? Reversible. And they produce responses that are so targeted that they're actually predictable. Predictable responses. Now, rapid, regulated, repeatable, and all those things don't match evolutionary theory, but they certainly would match a tracking system theory. So here's the theory part. And this is Francis Aiello. He was the head of the American Academy of Sciences for quite some time. He published in the paper, PNAS, which is the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. That's the United States' elite scientific organization. This was the headline of his paper: Darwin's Greatest Discovery, Design Without a Designer. That headline, that title is right on target. That is Darwin's greatest discovery, is design without a designer. Because if I were to ask you, what was the purpose of evolutionary theory? Most of you might say, well, it was to explain the origin of life, or maybe the origin of creatures, or maybe the diversity of life on Earth. All of those are somewhat true. But the main reason that evolutionary theory was developed was to answer this question: how can organisms, I don't care which one you look at, how can organisms look so incredibly designed without a designer? Because everybody sees organisms as incredibly designed. Even lost people see it. Even Darwin saw it. And this has been the question for a long time. And you know what? That is the biblical general revelation of God, is that every creature, all creatures, look really, really well designed. They fit their environments really well. Fish fit the water incredibly well. Birds fit the air incredibly well. Some of us fit our clothes on all of those things. There's a fit, and it's explaining the fit. It's explaining this design that was the hurdle. Because up until Darwin, people didn't want to have the design, but they really stumbled over it. How do you get past the design? Darwin came up with a way to get past the design. I'm going to explain to you how in the world he did it. In fact, I'm going to use some quotes from major evolutionists. This man, Stephen Jay Gould, this is a young picture of him when he was just, you know, really young, teaching at Harvard University. He's passed away since then. He was an atheist. He's an evolutionist, and in my opinion, he's one of the best evolutionists that ever lived, one of the most thoughtful ones. Way back early in his career, when he was young looking like that, and they took these nice faculty photos. Nowadays, if you try to see a faculty, it's a selfie that they post on things. Anyway, he asked him a really important question. What is the motor of organic change? He's asking what? How does adaptation happen? What's the motor of organic change? That's just a fancy way of saying, how does adaptation happen? More specifically, how are life and Earth related? That's really important too, because adaptation means that you're relating to your environment. I mean, if the environment's not changing, you're not going to change. But if it's changing, you're going to change. You can't put static things in dynamic environments and hope that they're going to persist. If you have a dynamic environment, you better put a dynamic thing in it. That's the point of this. And then he gets to the root of the question. Does the external environment and its alterations set the course of change? That's one explanation. The environment is running the show. It's driving it. And then he has a big or, which should be in caps. Or does change arise from some independent and internal dynamic within organisms themselves? In other words, the creature's running the show. See that? I'm relating to my environment. Is the environment running the show for me? Or am I running the show as I relate to the environment? Up until Darwin's time, the answer was internal. There's something in creatures that allow them to adapt. There's something in creatures that are doing this. There's something in creatures. The problem is, when you're pointing to things inside creatures, it sounds way too much like what? Design. So, over 20 years later, when Gould is dying, he wrote this really thick book called The Structure of Evolutionary Theory. A really valuable book. I'm probably one of the few people who's actually read it. A lot of people have it on their bookshelves, but when I ask them, what'd you think of it? Well, they haven't read it on that. And it's long. Some paragraphs are one sentence. I'd never get away with that for facts and facts. Anyway, and so he's going to explain a lot of things. And this is what he says when he's talking about what Darwin did. I proceed in this way for a very principled reason. There's a reason he's going to tell us what Darwin did. And not merely as convenience. All major evolutionary theories before Darwin. Darwin did come up with the idea of evolution. But all the theories before Darwin are presenting a fundamentally internalistic account based on the intrinsic and predictable patterns set by the nature of living systems for the development unfolding through time. Do you know what? Before Darwin, they were really right on track. They were really right on track. And before Darwin, what they believed is going to line up with what we know today from science. So they were on track. They were saying creatures are adapting because there's something in the creatures that make them adapt. He goes on to say this. Darwin's theory in strong and what? Revolutionary contrast presents the first externalist account of evolution. Darwin overturned all previous traditions by thus granting the external environment a causal and controlling role in the direction of evolutionary change. So Darwin caused a paradigm shift, and he didn't do it overnight. It actually took decades for Darwin to bring this paradigm shift about. But he fundamentally said, adaptation doesn't happen through internal mechanisms. It's happening where? Externally. The environment changes, and it drives you to change. Your changes are due to environmental changes. So he's taking causality from where? Inside, and he's putting it outside. This is Gould's colleague. He's still alive, Richard Lewontin. He was there when I was at Harvard, but I wanted to meet him. I never could get to meet him because he wasn't on campus. Anyway, he's going to explain what Darwin did. For Darwin, the external world, the environment acting on organisms, was the cause of the form of organisms. The environment, the external world with its autonomous properties, was the subject, and the organism was again the object acted upon. He goes on to say, it is from this view of the environment, catch these words, as the cause of what? Organism. That means from soup to nuts. You start out with environmental things, and it's going to bring about the origin of life. You start out with environmental changes, it's going to lead to the diversity of life. So the environment becomes the cause of organism. That the entire corpus of modern biology arises. And I can guarantee you, if you were taught biology in the last 100 years, which includes everybody, this is how you were taught. This is how I was taught. This is how they teach it at University of Wyoming. This is how they teach it at Harvard. This is how they teach it everywhere. And everybody thinks this way, including a bunch of creationists. It's the environment that's running the show. Why do creationists even think this? Because we went to schools that taught it. And it's you end up seeing the world from this perspective, that it's the environment that's molding you and shaping you and bringing you about. He goes on to say, we cannot fully appreciate the nature of the change in biology wrought by Mendel. Mendel brought in what? Genetics. And Darwin, who brought in this externalism, unless we understand the historical importance of the objectification of the organism, which means the environment is the actor and the organism is acted upon. Gould goes on to say, externalists identified the agent of change not within organisms themselves, but in a fluctuating external environment. Now, he brings up another important word in that quote. And the word is what? Agent. Agent. An agent. Is God an agent? That's not a hard question. God is an agent. Are you an agent? Yes. Is your dog an agent? Yes. That was an affirmation. That was like an amen on that. Yes, yes, yes. You're an agent. This is really important. Because if you're going to explain design without a designer, you have to come up with a substitute what? Agent. You have to come up with a substitute agent. Now, if you're an agent, that means you can exercise agency. How do you exercise agency? This is going to be really important. I said God is an agent. He exercises agency because God has volition, God has will, and God can act. Do you have volition and a will and can act? Yes, you do. Does even your dog have volition and a will? Of course they do. I mean, you can see it all the time. They can make choices. They have volition. They have will. In fact, agency is really one of the hallmarks of living things, is that we have agency. And God demonstrates his agency in human history in two fundamental ways. One is creation, and the other one is redemption, where he steps into human history on that. So God is demonstrating his agency first and foremost by the fact that he is the creator and he's the maker. So if you want to explain design without a designer, you have to come up with a substitute agent. That's really important. So now, that's why this phrase is important. Externalists identified the what? Agent of change with the external environment. Kirshner and Gerhardt, as your professors at UC Berkeley and Harvard, they wrote this book, The Plausibility of Life. It's really a pretty good one, a few years ago. But they explain what Darwin thought. He, that is Darwin, accepted the view that the environment directly instructs the organism how to vary. Stop right there. Really important. That phrase. And you know what? Most people skip over it, creationist and evolutionist. And I'm pounding it because it's really important. Does that phrase indicate elements of agency? You better believe it does. The environment does what? Directly instructs. If that is an agency, what is? The environment directly instructs the organism how to change. Now, this is really important because if the organism is changing itself, you're swapping the causality out from the organism and you're putting it where? In the environment, in nature. So we'll just call it nature. Now, that phrase is really important because I could show it to you in hundreds of papers. I could show you in major biology textbooks this exact same phrase the environment was instructing. So that phrase is important because he's going to show substitute agency. Please hang with me with this theory. It's really important. But is it true? No. How in the world does the environment send instructions? You know what? Do you know how many professors at University of Wyoming accept that statement without giving it a second thought? And if I were to ask them, is it true? Their knee-jerk reaction would be yes. And then I would say, well, how does the environment send instructions? And where do you detect the environment sending instructions? Here, anybody got an instruction detector? How in the world is it doing it? And yet it's something that is accepted axiomatically without giving it a second thought, but it is not true in the slightest. It's not true at all. I'm adjusting when I detect the change in the environment, but they see it as the environment sending me instructions, telling me to change. And they have it totally wrong. So not is it wrong, but it transfers and it projects onto nature agency. This is really important. I mean, these are fundamental things which everybody's missing, but this is the intersection of Darwin's theory with theology. They go on to say, the organism was like modeling clay. And remolding the clay meant that each of the billions of little grains was free to move a little bit in any direction to generate change. So now the environment is the agent, and the organisms are what? Modeling clay. And who's doing the modeling? Nature is doing the modeling. And Helena Cronin, she's a famous evolutionist from Great Britain, pretty influential too. She said, all of this, apparent design, and she's using the word apparent on purpose, means not real design, because real design would have a real designer. But there is no real designer, so this is only apparent design. Has come about without a designer. No purpose, no goals, no blueprints. Natural selection is simply about genes replicating themselves down through generations. So now, Darwin is going to take the designer out, and he is going to put a substitute designer in. He's going to get God's agency out, and he's going to put a substitute agent in. His substitute agent is what? Nature, the environment. So his substitute agent becomes nature itself. Now, this is really important. If you're going to give the environment the ability to exercise volition like an agent does, then you must prescribe to the environment the ability to what? Select. Bingo. Bingo. And so now you have nature selecting, natural selection. And Darwin eased the idea of natural selection in by saying, look at what pigeon breeders, and he was looking at pigeon breeders. Look at what pigeon breeders can do by selecting for this trait, selecting for that trait, selecting. They can get all these different varieties of pigeons within just a few years. If nature was selecting for those traits and nature had a really long time to do it, then you could get a lot of different traits. His analogy was initially resisted by some thoughtful people, but eventually gained the day. Is the analogy valid? No. It's a totally invalid analogy. And you know what? I guarantee you 99% of the professors at UW, biology professors, don't even catch it. Why it's an invalid analogy. If I take a pigeon breeder, does a pigeon breeder have real agency? Can a pigeon breeder make real selections? Does a pigeon breeder have a real brain? Yes, yes, yes. Does nature have a brain? No. And you know what? That phrase right there is even resisted by people. When I say, does nature have a brain? You said no. But I'll guarantee you, you'll be a bunch of professors at UW would say, well, I don't know. There's something about nature. There's something about it that seems to operate like a living being. And they'll say that. But when you project onto nature the ability to select, then you are projecting onto nature volitional capabilities, and you are projecting onto nature agency. And so he eased the idea of agency in nature by projecting onto nature the ability to select. That was it. And that is the key. And all of those are wrong and phony. Now, how does that intersect theology? Well, pretty fundamentally. Very fundamentally. Because Darwin is going to come up with the design without a designer explanation, which is an atheistic explanation. Why is it an atheistic explanation? I mean, Darwin never comes out and says there is no God. Does Darwin ever come out and say there is no God? No. He doesn't do it. He goes one better. He says there is no creator. There is no creator. And which is the same thing as saying there is no what? God. Because who God is fundamentally, first and foremost, he's the creator of all things. So he doesn't come out and just say, no God. He comes out more subtle, no creator. No creator. Okay, that's where it intersects theology in point number one. But it intersects theology in another way, which we should catch. When we project onto an unconscious thing like nature, nature's full of living creatures, but nature itself is not alive. When we project onto an unconscious thing conscious-like abilities and volitional abilities from a Christian or Jewish standpoint, what is that called? Idolatry. That's what it's called. It's idolatrous. If I held up to you a statue of a saint, and I said, you pray to this saint and it'll select your mate, young man. You pray to that and it'll select your saint, it'll select your mate. Or I give you a little rabbit's foot, you rub that baby. Everybody immediately, instantly sees the idolatry in it. But it's a little subtler because Darwin isn't holding up a statue and projecting onto it abilities. He's holding up what? Nature. And he projects onto nature. And then therefore you end up in a position where people are no longer worshiping God the Creator. They're worshiping what? Nature. Hey, does anybody see that today? And that's that long, tortuous story through my talk is connecting the dots of how you get to this point, of how you got to this point, and why it's so plausible, and why all those smart people at UW or South Dakota School of Mines or anybody else, why they can buy into it. Because it seems to have this element of believability in science. But the point is, it's all wrong. All of it wrong. And you know where it exists? Only in one place, in your mind. So the question would be to you, people in the back row, where does idolatry exist? In the statue or in your mind? It's in your mind. And it has been and always will be in your mind. Idolatry is what you believe about the statue. It's what you believe about the totem pole. It's what you believe about the golden calf. That's where idolatry always begins. And so Darwin's theory is new, but it's not new. It's just more sophisticated. It's a more sophisticated way of idolatry, of substituting a substitute designer. That's where it intersects theology. Wow. Now, how many of you like natural selection? I find it repugnant. I find it's a mystical construct. And I'll explain why on that. It's bad in every way. Okay, so how do we push back against it? Replace it. Replace it with the truth. Replace it with a real mechanism. Now, I showed you yesterday some magical convergences, like a dolphin with fins looking like a shark with fins, where evolutionists say, well, they just seem to converge on those traits. Let's test it against some real convergences where we see organisms converge in real time on specific traits. And let's try to explain those. And in fact, it can happen to almost any trait. This man, Jonathan Lossos, was in Harvard University. He's the world's leading researcher on what kind of animal? Well, we're not in Texas. They're what? Lizards, of course. That's the clue. He's holding one of those babies up. He does research on lizards. 2017, he wrote a book, and he said, in recent years, scientists have identified convergence in almost any trait you might imagine. It means organisms are converging on all different kinds of traits. Well, how would I explain it from a continuous environmental tracking model? What if organisms have sensors, and they do, and they have condition consequence logic? That means if they detect a condition, you're going to get a particular and necessary response, which is a consequence, and they're going to have a suitable response. What happens if, with those sensors, they detected similar conditions? And what happens if they had similar programming? Then you would expect what kind of responses? Similar. Well, let's go back to that cave. And I mentioned the cave, and I showed the blind cavefish yesterday. But what is the programming? Well, these are things that we can identify scientifically. We can identify mechanisms to lose eyes, lose pigmentation, and do other kinds of things, but also gain some functions. Gain the ability to stay awake, increase taste and smell and mechanical sensation. That means vibrations. So would that be useful in a cave? You lose your eyes, you want to be able to detect the other stuff around you. Well, what if lots of organisms had those same kind of programming? You might not just expect blind cavefish, but blind salamanders, blind cave crawfish, blind insects, and all different kinds of creatures that when they get in a cave, they do these exact same things. That's quite remarkable. And they do it quite rapidly. They don't do it over many, many generations. Well, how would we explain this? Similar sensors, similar programming, similar responses. Not just in fish, but in all different kinds of creatures. Here's another example. Can everybody read that headline? Let me see. Oh, it's this one. What does it say? Rapid and repeated origins of insular giantism and dwarfism in Australian tiger snakes. How many want to read that paper? You'd probably say, no. But I get paid to read this stuff. But that caught my attention. What kind of changes? Rapid and repeatable. Rapid and repeatable. So what it is, you got these tiger snakes that live on Australia, on the southern coast of Australia, and suddenly they find themselves migrating. I don't know how they do this. They get carried out or something. But they get carried to islands around the coast of Australia. And when they get to those islands, some of them go to a giant form, but more often than not, they go to a dwarf form. So you get these dwarf tiger snakes. Not one of them becomes dwarfs, but all of them become dwarfs. And they do it rapidly. And if you take the DNA of a mainland tiger snake, a giant, and a dwarf, they're essentially genetically identical to each other. So you don't have a bunch of mutations changing them. But they're changing in response to things that they detect really, really rapidly. And it's not just snakes that go to dwarfs. All kinds of creatures, when they find themselves on islands, go to dwarfs. Look at that little chameleon standing on a match head. That's a dwarf. Even dinosaurs they found went to dwarfs when they were on islands. So it's been happening since the time of the creation. You see that little elephant there? You can see that. You can actually see that skeleton in Hot Springs, South Dakota at the Mammoth Cave. That elephant is waist high on me, fully grown. It's a dwarf. A dwarf elephant. And all of these go to these dwarf forms when they get isolated on these islands. And maybe even human beings went to dwarf forms when they went to that. Okay, here's another example. How many of you see the dark kind of blackish beetle on the left? Do you see the ants on the right? But those aren't ants. There's a big arrow that's pointing from the beetle to the ants. That's because this beetle lives where there's army ants. And army ants are quite vicious. But when this beetle detects the presence of army ants, it morphs into the shape of an army ant. That's quite remarkable. And so it morphs. It's called a rove beetle. It morphs into these shapes. So here you go. Ant, beetle. Ant, beetle. And these are all, they're all beetles. They're not ants. They're beetles that look like ants. And they morph to look like an ant. Not only do they look like an ant, they smell like an ant. They behave like an ant. So much so that the ants take them into their colony. And these beetles then start to take care of the little brood of developing ants. But they don't really do it, you know, beneficially, because it's like two for you, one for me. And they eat the brood of the ants on that. Suddenly the army ants become the prey. There's a real big blow up of one. And the people who study these things say they have to stay. Now, this is a job I wouldn't want to have. They study these ants all day long trying to pick out the beetles on them. And they're so close to them, it's really, really hard to do. And not only that, these ants can morph into at least nine different types of these. These beetles can morph into at least nine different species of ants, lookalikes. And when you find them in the fossil record, the beetles have been doing this since there were ants. And they've been doing it all along. Well, how in the world do we explain this? So let's start reading some quotes from these scientific papers. This paper right here, published in Current Biology, one of the leading evolutionary journals, they propose that the beetles are, quote, poised for myrmecophily. That means they start to look like an ant. The beetles were what? Poised. Poised. I mean, from an evolutionary standpoint, is any creature supposed to be poised to do anything? No. But from a continuous environmental tracking where you have programming and logic, you could be poised. And at this near clade-wide, what? Pre-adaptive ground plan. Pre-adaptive ground plan may underlie the repeated ant mimicry. That's interesting. That's certainly not consistent with evolutionary theory, but it'd be consistent with what I'm proposing. The American Academy of Sciences, in a REEK alert, reports on this. The discovery published in Current Biology provides evidence, this is a quote, that evolution has the capacity to repeat itself in an astonishingly predictable way. Predictable evolution? I wonder how many profs at UW know about this. Because this isn't consistent with their theory, but it's certainly consistent with the design theory. Oh, by the way, how many of you caught the personification of nature in that phrase? I mean, you're at this conference. You want to get your money's worth. Where's the personification? Evolution has the capacity to repeat itself. You have the capacity to repeat yourself, but does evolution, a non-personal thing, have any capacities? No. That's a personification. That's right there. I mean, it gets printed in scientific publications, and nobody's even catching this magic that's put in scientific papers. Okay. Here's another creature. These are called these little stick spiders. The people who research these are suffering for science in Hawaii. And you'll see there's different morphs. This is a gold morph. This gold variety lives on leaves. But there's a brown variety which lives on tree trunks. And there's a white type which lives on lichen and moss. And what does that headline say? The title, Repeated Diversification of Ecomorphs. And these Hawaiian stick spiders. And what they found was this. You take a gold stick spider on one Hawaiian island, and it migrates to the other Hawaiian island, and it will morph into the brown and white forms before the brown and white forms on this island get to that island. And it does it over and over again, and it does it quite quickly. So how does the gal, who is the main researcher, how does she explain this? Quote, "We don't usually expect evolution to be what? Predictable." And they don't. But we're going to see it happens a lot. But Hawaiian stick spiders of the Rhamnus genus have repeatedly evolved the same distinctive forms known as incomorphs on different Hawaiian islands. She goes on to say the spiders, quote, "arrive on an island and boom." Boom? You get independent evolution to the same sort of form, the same, this sort of rapid and what? Repeated evolution. I mean, is evolution supposed to go boom? No. Mm-mm. Because evolution was supposed to be what? Very gradual. It's not supposed to be a boom. It's supposed to be like what? A little fizzle. Like a little burning fuse there. But it's never supposed to go boom. So that's completely contrary to theory. But it's not contrary to a design-based tracking model. She goes on to ask, "We can ask whether there might be an underlying mechanism that leads to the similar patterns of predictably repeated evolution in the course of adapted radiation." Yeah, I'd like to ask if there isn't some kind of underlying mechanism. Where would that mechanism be? In the creature or out of the creature? In the creature. It's in that baby. Where was it for the rove beetles? In them also. She adds that the Aramnus spiders have some sort of pre-programmed switch in their DNA, huh? At least she's catching where the cause is. It's in their DNA that can be quickly turned on to allow them to evolve rapidly into these successful forms. But how this process might work is still unclear. Ah, this is where a theory of design can make predictions. What would I predict? These spiders have a what? Sensor. And they have logic, and they have responses. So if she doesn't know about the sensors yet, I'm going to predict. Look for the sensors. Look for the logic. I'll bet there is a pre-programmed switch. Oh, by the way, what is a switch? A switch is a logic device. 0, 1. On, off. Right, left. Start, stop. A switch is always a logic device. That's what's in there. Is any of this interesting? Okay, good. I find it quite interesting. Here's another cool one. Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I bet you never read so many scientific papers in church. What is this title of this paper? Lizards on newly created islands, what independently and rapidly adapt in morphology and diet. Okay, I'll turn around and explain. This was a river. They put a dam in. And when they dammed up the river, it flooded the valley rapidly, making independent islands. Boom! So you have lizards living everywhere. You flood it, and now you're trapping lizards on separate islands. Oh, cool experiment on a really big scale. On some of those islands, some big lizards went extinct. And yet little lizards, which normally did not eat the termites, suddenly they could start eating termites. The trouble is, you're little and the termites are big. So you need a big head to eat those termites. And sometime in less than 15 years, I wish they would have gone back sooner, the head on those little termites got big. In fact, it got big compared to its body length, that you ended up with two separate populations between mainland and the ones on the islands of big head to body length compared to head to body length, which was before. So they got this big head in order to eat those big termites, and they did it quickly. And the paper says this, they said it was strong evidence that traits change predictably and what? Precisely. In ecological communities, and illustrates that populations can respond both rapidly and in parallel to ecological changes, which means this. On all of the independent islands, all of the lizards got the big head to body length on all of them and happening. Now, does that sound like an internally regulated mechanism which is allowing them to do this all over the place? The only reason why they're not coming up with this is because they don't think that way, and it really sounds way too designed. Here we go. Jonathan Losos again. He suffers for science in the Caribbean, and he does research on these lizards all over the Caribbean. And he's a pretty careful researcher, does a lot of careful measurements. And you have all different kinds of islands in the Caribbean. Some of these islands have vegetation, which is basically just like sagebrush, like we would see, short, scrubby little vegetation. And some of the islands have big, tall trees. And the lizards that live on islands with trees have long legs, because long legs are good for going up and down trees. And the lizards that live on basically sagebrush have short, little stubbier legs, which is better for sagebrush. Well, a hurricane came through and killed all the island, all the lizards on seven islands, wiped them all out. So this gave him an opportunity to do a natural experiment. He took and it wiped them out on the sagebrush islands. So he took lizards living in trees and he repopulated the sagebrush islands. Kind of cool. And this is what he said. Our prediction. Now, wait a second. Are you supposed to be able to predict what evolution is going to do? Mm-mm. Our prediction was that they would evolve shorter legs. You notice how they use the word evolution in terms of just their own self-adjusting capacity? And what? And they did. Over the course of what? 4 years. Average limb length steadily declined on all seven islands, exactly as predicted. And all seven islands were evolving in lockstep. Random mechanisms or highly regulated mechanisms? External or internal? Internal. This guy does research on snakes, obviously. Parallel selective pressure drive convergent diversification of phenotypes. There you go. There's this externalism. Parallel selective pressures are doing what? Driving it. That's the externalism. Anyway, this is the bottom line. He did research on pythons and boas. Pythons and boas supposedly separated by 60 million years of evolution. One lays eggs, one gives birth to live young. But the key thing is this. He has pythons and boas, and he's looking at them in these five different environments. Arboreal means they live in trees. Semi, partial trees, partial land. Terrestrial, clearly land. Semi-aquatic, and I didn't even know this. Fossorial, that means on the land and underground. But if you look at the pythons and boas, in each of their distinct environment, they have distinctive traits for each of them. And in fact, the python looks more like a boa living in tree than it does another python living in the water or underground. And not only that, the pythons look very similar to each other. How in the world are they rapidly converging on these traits? And why are they doing it? There's something about these traits that are suitable for those environments. Anyway, he just adds how plastic his theory is. The convergence between pythons and boas adds to the recent body of evidence demonstrating that evolution can still be predictable, except when it's not predictable. That's how their theory is, right? It's predictable when it's not predictable. It makes you tall except when it makes you short. It makes you fast except when it makes you slow. It does anything. Okay, Hopi Hoekstra. She's a researcher at Harvard University, and she does research on mice. She's probably the best researcher in the world on mice. She does a lot of her research in Nebraska, just in the northern part on the southern Nebraska-South Dakota border. There's a bunch of sand dunes there. Anyway, this was an interesting report that she had on mice that were living in prairies. And mice that live in prairies have a short tail. But when those mice migrate to the east and west coast where they start living in forests, they have a long tail. Because the mice no longer start living on the ground, they start living in trees. I've never seen, personally, mice living in trees myself. all the mice are what I see around here, which is like all over the ground. But somehow these mice, when they get to the trees, they independently grow long tails. And there's an x-ray of them. East Coast, West Coast, prairie-dwelling short mice, and then long-tailed forest mice on both coasts. And this is what she says about her findings. From a short-tailed prairie-dwelling ancestor. Now, I've practiced that phrase. Say it. Short-tailed prairie-dwelling ancestor. I mean, that's a good one from a short-tailed prairie-dwelling ancestor. For geographically distinct populations across North America, longer tails have evolved what? Repeatedly. How about they self-adjusted? In similar forested habitat, variation in these traits is controlled by separate genetic loci. What is she saying? The genes for number of vertebrae are different than the genes for making longer vertebrae. And with these mice, their tails got longer by both increasing the length of the vertebrae and the number of vertebrae. So the number wasn't static. She said this suggests that this is not a stochastic process. Stochastic is just a fancy word for saying random. She says this isn't random, but implicates similar mechanisms of tail elongation in eastern and western forested populations. Similar mechanisms, external or internal? Internal. What about bacteria? This is published in Nature. Nature fancies itself as the world's leading scientific journal. Look at the title of this report. Predictable evolution trumps randomness of mutations. Now, would you even expect that in a scientific paper about evolution? Predictable mutations is trumping randomness? I mean, it's trumping it. And they put this in before Trump was ever elected. So this is like the real Trump. The Trump trumped you there on those kinds of things. So now you're having predictable evolution. Well, evolution was never supposed to be predictable. So that just shows the plastic theory. But here's the first sentence. Although mutations, the driver of evolution, occur at random. Stop right there. How many profs at UW probably repeat that? All of them. Are there scientific papers which document that these are random? No. How would you document it, that it's random? You don't. This is a statement of faith, and it's a mantra that gets repeated over and over and over again. But there's nobody documenting that these are random. In fact, if you read the rest of the paper, they're not random. This was a study of bacteria E. coli. Reveals that nature often finds the same solution to the same problem again and again. They expose these bacteria to similar stresses, and it said identical mutations appeared independently in all three test tubes. So they're coming up with this. All right, I'm waiting for you to stop me before I push the button and say, Dr. Galuza, did you catch the personification of nature in what you just read? Or did you just mindlessly read it, Dr. Galuza? How many of you see a personification in this scientific paper? What's the personification? Nature often finds the same solution. It's everywhere. Once you start to see it, you'll see this personifications everywhere. And it gets through peer review. What do you mean nature often finds the same solution? How about there's similar programming to do similar things in different creatures, and we can identify the programming? Isn't that a little more scientific than saying nature often finds? That's really important. They go on to say, bacteria such as E. coli can acquire predictable mutations. Wait a second. Predictable mutations? To adapt to changing environments. Okay. How might all this stuff that I've just outlined happen? What might be some mechanisms and systems? Well, I mentioned to you yesterday about these blind cavefish. How in the world does that happen? Multiple mechanisms. Some are epigenetic, some are this one, heat shock protein. What this is, I'll explain it to you. Proteins need to fold to get a specific shape. Sometimes they can fold spontaneously, but sometimes they're so complicated that another protein called the chaperone helps them fold into their precise shape. If you change the function of the chaperone, you can get different shapes with the proteins. And when you get different shapes, you can go from sided to unsided. So you modulate how the chaperone works. Not through mutations, but through a highly regulated process. And it's through the modulation of this chaperone protein, which is called heat shock protein 90, which gives you the different expressions of these proteins. Do you remember yesterday I mentioned what they detect? They detect what? Water conductivity. And there's other mechanisms which can help lead to this blind cavefish, which I mentioned happens in one generation. What about those lizards? Well, Jonathan Losos, several years ago, he did a really interesting experiment on these lizards. And he took 120 newly hatched lizards, bang, just hatched, and he randomly segregated them into two groups. And he put a bunch of these in multiple aquaria, and inside the aquarium were wide boards simulating tree trunks. And he took the other random group, put those in different aquarium with dowel rods in them simulating twigs. And they were newly hatched. And by the time they reached maturity, the ones that grew up on the boards had long legs, and the ones that grew up on the dowel rods had short legs. No evolution. But he doesn't know how that happens. How might you suggest that it could happen? See, now you get to be the scientist, or you get to be the engineer. These lizards have what? Sensors. They have sensors, mechanical sensors, and when they're sensing the different stresses of what they're walking on, signals are sent in, modulating bone deposition, giving long legs and short legs. That's pretty straightforward. I know it happens. I know you sense bone deposition. I could put a band around your head right now and slowly tighten it if I was one of those biologists. And within months, you'd have like a band head on your head, because the bone would sense the forces, and cells which break down bone would start breaking down bone, and it would remodel it to be the shape that I put around your head. I would never do that, but I'm just saying I could do that on that. So if you can do that, why aren't these lizards detecting these things even as they're maturing? These are all different kinds of mechanisms. We'll end with this last one. We have some more, but we're just about out of time, and I think I've made the point. This guy does research on these baby cichlid fish. He's at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. It's really interesting. He noticed as they're developing, their mouth opens and closes as their little embryos rapidly, sometimes 200 times a minute. He's wondering, what in the world is that doing, you know, that movement, and does it have any purpose? So he took some of the fish and he wired their mouth close. That's what they do. So he kind of like stopped the movement of the mouth. And by the time they reached maturity, they had a different skull. The shape was different. Their jaw was different. Does that make sense? Of course it does, because you've got forces of those muscles and doing all of that stuff affecting your development. But what he said about this was really important. He said, for over 100 years, we've been taught that the ability of a system to evolve depends largely on the amount of genetic variation that exists for a trait. And they had a misprint in their article, but I printed it exactly how it was. What is ignored or not noted for most traits is that less than 50% of, I should have said, phenotypic variation, that is the expression of your traits, can typically be accounted for by genetics. Which means this, the genes are not the be-all and end-all of your traits. You can't blame it on you have the skinny gene, or you have the fat gene, or you have any other kind of gene. You have genes which affect multiple traits, and multiple traits are affected by multiple genes. And how those genes are expressed during development because of things that the organism detects during development and during its lifetime affect your traits as well. He goes on to say, the idea is that when an animal population is exposed to a new environment, certain molecules will enable them to respond by conforming their bodies to meet new challenges. I couldn't have written that any better. That's fully internalistic, fully describing what we're seeing here. Oh, this gentleman here, this is a great quote, but I'm going to pass him up. Sorry, Dr. Shapiro, on that. We'll end on all of these things right here. So, take-home messages from today's talk. We can come up with a better way to explain adaptation. But more important than explaining adaptation, what we really want to explain is, why do organisms look so well designed? And we have the explanation, because they were designed. Because they were designed. That's why they look so well designed, because they were designed. And we can push back against Darwin's explanation. So please rephrase it for me. Darwin projects onto what selective capacity? Nature. Which is, he's giving nature then volition, which means he's giving nature agency. And he's doing that so he can get God's agency, what? Out, and put in a substitute agent in its place. And when you project onto unconscious nature things which it doesn't have, like volitional capacity, it's really just an expression of idolatry. So he comes up with an idolatrous substitute for God creating nature. In other words, nature creates itself. And that's how he's going to explain it. And I guarantee you that's how it's going to be taught at the University of Wyoming. Nature creates itself through Big Bang and then through natural selection. But it's not true. We can point out that his whole explanation that change was externally imposed on creatures by the environment is wrong. Because we can show internal mechanisms. Internal mechanisms, which is the opposite of externalism. So catch these. Design says internal. We build into the train. We build into the computer. We build into the car. We build into the space shuttle. Everything it needs to have internally. Evolution is external. The internalism says modifications are highly regulated. Externalism says they're undirected. Internalism says responses are rapid. Externalism says, no, they're gradual. Internalism says that you have targeted responses, so targeted they're predictable. Evolution says, no, they're hit and miss, they're trial and error, they're copious, of which nature selects the winners. So what he came up with was the anti-design explanation for how organisms can look so designed. That's what he was after. And that's why we need to see it. And we push back against it by building our own framework to explain adaptation, which says that organisms continuously track environmental changes through internal mechanisms, which rely on three fundamental components: sensors, logic, and output responses. That's the response, and that's a better response. Well, we've hit our time, Pastor. I think I talk longer than you, so you don't look so bad on Sunday mornings. You're welcome on that. And I'll turn it back to you.